All right, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Show. Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org is my website. You can go there if you want. Got 3,500 interviews or so, 36, going back to 2003. And find all the rest of my stuff there. You can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, if you like that. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, and also police state stuff, but it's still all the same empire, isn't it? A little bit of exporting our ways to the world and a little bit of importing the measures that we use against them and using them against ourselves. Well, yeah, no, our government using them against us domestically, is what I'm trying to say. You know, where's the health of the state and all that, like in all the warnings that everybody ignored. But yeah, that's basically it. I try to debunk the war propaganda best as I can. And so today on the show, to that end, Dr. Ron Paul will be here to talk about the new authorization to use military force against the Islamic State. And then Scott McConnell will be on to talk about, well, the Ukraine crisis, but the politics of the Ukraine crisis in Washington, D.C., it's really something else. And I really like Scott McConnell and his writing. He's a really smart guy. He had me introduce him at that Council for the National Interest, re-examining the American-Israel Special Relationship Conference that IRMEP and CNI put on. He had me introduce him as a former neocon. So he's a, I guess, more of a paleocon now, but first was a leftist who then turned right-wing warmonger like the rest of these kooks around Bill Kristol and then smartened up. And I think he smartened up at the end of the Cold War. I think it's been better than a generation since he smartened up. But anyway, I guess was part of that movement to a degree. Writes for the American Conservative now and has a great one. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. The ambitions driving the Ukraine crisis. And then you look at it, and of course the first thing is that cross-eyed idiot Michelle Flournoy from the Center for New American Security, which is just the Democrats' PNAC, the lady who is the high priestess of the counterinsurgency doctrine that failed in Iraq, and so they did it again in Afghanistan, where it also failed, where she was Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy and ran the whole crew of the propagandists for the brilliant, newly rewritten counterinsurgency doctrine of the Archangel David Petraeus, sent down to us by baby Jesus to win our wars for us. And yeah, she lost two wars, Michelle Flournoy, but, you know, she's the one who told the New York Times outright that the reason she did not want to replace Hagel as Obama's Secretary of Defense is because she was waiting for Hillary. She's placing her bets. She wants to be the Secretary of Defense for Hillary. That way she can last more than a couple of years into the new administration and be replaced by somebody else. So, according to Scott McConnell, that's a big part of why she wants us to arm the Ukrainians, too. Personal ambition. Just like how Samantha Power helped convince Hillary Clinton, who then, boy, did she take that task on as a project of her own. But Samantha Power, as is told in Michael Hastings' great piece about the war in Libya, it's not that great of a piece, actually. There's some flaws in that thing. Martyr to great journalism that he was. But anyway, he quotes in there Samantha Power complaining that she was tired of doing do-gooder, rinky-dink stuff like protecting Christians in Iraq and helping democracy, whatever that is, in Iraq. She didn't want to do that. You know, things like trying to stave off current civil war over there. No, she wanted attention. She'd been relegated to the lower staff levels of the National Security Council and didn't really have Obama's ear. And now she'd been patient. She'd waited her 2 years now in frustrated silence as the deputy assistant secretary of doing do-gooder rinky-dink stuff on the National Security Council. And this was her chance. So she went to Susan Rice and said, let's you and me go and convince Hillary Clinton that this will be like that time that we didn't stop the genocide in Rwanda, only this time we will, and it'll be great, and everyone will win PR points and get a promotion. And they went and did it. And it was all about them. It was all about those three women and what they wanted for themselves. Jesus, Scott, are you sure that America is really backing a war for the Mujahideen against a secular socialist, clean-shaven dictator in Libya? That doesn't make sense. Oh, yes, you see, but there are three women who want a promotion. And so, and of course, all their staff under them, they all want promotions too. Everybody move up one step by supporting a war. I guess in Libya, they only got a whole bunch of people killed. In the case of picking a fight with the Russians, they might just get us all killed. Wouldn't that suck if no science fiction stuff from the future ever came true at all, because humanity didn't even last through the rest of, you know, the decade or this century? Or were reduced through nuclear warfare to some primitive pre-market state of existence? Gamma rays everywhere and stuff. Could happen. People like to pretend that it couldn't happen just because statistically it hasn't happened since 1945. But, you know, I'm not so sure. I've read some statisticians saying, man, there are thousands of nukes. We gotta pare that number down quick. Because my probability chart is at 2 seconds to midnight. Picking a fight with the Russians. Why? Because pathetic bureaucrats like Michelle Flournoy want attention. That's why. So we can all die. Which you gotta admit, a nuclear explosion would be pretty cool to see, you know, in real life, even if you died right after that. It's a pretty cool way to die, right? The whole city going out with you at the same time? No? Is that just me? I guess that is just me. Maybe that's not even me. No, I guess I'd rather die alone. But, you know, there are a lot of people who would very much like to see a nuclear war. They think that the Bible says they need one to force Jesus to come back. Somehow these people are the Israelis' best allies when their plan has Jesus nuking all the Jews in Israel. But, hey, as Irving Kristol said, it's their theology. It's our Israel. So, in other words, thanks for the money, you idiots. Thanks for the Republican votes, Cornerstone Church. I don't know. It's funny, though, isn't it, how nuclear weapons aren't even a public policy issue whatsoever. 25 years after the end of the Cold War, America and Russia both armed to the teeth with thousands of hydrogen bombs. And, of course, France, Britain, Israel, India, Pakistan as well. North Korea now, too. Did I say China? China. Wow, we could have led an effort to get rid of these things. All wars are bad enough, but... man, with nukes, we ought to just not even have nukes. Right? All 7 billion of y'all? Don't y'all agree with me about that? Why would anyone let a politician have a nuke? Are you crazy? A politician? Why would anyone let any politician have any nukes at all? That should be the start of the question, not why should we get rid of them. Who in the world came up with the idea of giving nukes to politicians? That's crazy. That's suicidal. All right. After this break, I'm going to complain about Iran, and then after that, I'm going to interview Ron Paul. Well, I'm not going to complain about Iran. I'm going to complain about Israel. You know what I mean. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I almost sort of kind of reached Dennis Kucinich for a minute. I did get one email back saying, try me tomorrow. That was a couple days ago. He must be a very busy guy. But I'm determined to interview him about his part of the story in that great Washington Times series about Hillary's war in Libya. And, yeah, it's really good. And you can see how, well, there's one Republican who likes it as a talking point. Not just Benghazi, but the whole dang Libya war. It's all on Hillary. Go and get her. You know, it's Rand Paul. That's a talking point of his. The rest of the Republican Party are all as bad or worse than her on that war. Because they're complete idiots. What are they thinking? They're so stupid and crazy. Anyway, so the right wing does not have much of a reason to attack her over that war, only over Benghazi, where she should have had better security if she's going to fight a war for our enemies, you know, with the GOP blessing, and then station our ambassador right in the middle of our ally enemy's hornet's nest to be killed. We want better guards, you understand. That's their scandal. And then the liberals, of course, just want to pretend that, what Libya war? I don't know about that or something. I really like Hillary Clinton because she's got a great new hairstyle or whatever the thing is. So they don't want to run with it either. It's interesting. It was in the Washington Times in the first place. Since when do they do good journalism other than, you know, publishing James Bovard on their editorial page? But they had a great series there. And anyway... And they treat Kucinich with respect in the thing, too, which is interesting for the Washington Times, you know. Anyway, great story. It comes with audio, and I promise to continue to try to get him on the show. That's all I can do. But anyway. All right, now on the Iran thing, I already mentioned this, but it's worth repeating. Netanyahu has openly declared, according to Israel National News, they have the entire statement that he gave to his cabinet here, that he will do everything he can to prevent a deal with Iran. And while at the same time, it seems like they are actually getting it going. Julian Borger, who is a great journalist at The Guardian in England, has this story, creative thinking gets Iran nuclear negotiations closer to a deal. I think this thing is pretty much a done deal. Remember, Phil Giraldi reported that the CIA had a team of guys in a room, basically sort of next door to the negotiators, during the secret behind-the-scenes talks in Oman, where the CIA analysts were going through and basically coming up with whatever sophisticated algorithm they could think of for what amounts to what breakout time and what threshold are we willing to tolerate and all that, and that they basically already worked it out. That was a year ago, that they have the outlines of the deal more or less worked out. There are possibly real, but also, I hope, more likely just PR-level differences. Well, we still want to change this number to that. Whatever, guys, just sign the damn thing at the end, would you, is the real point. So right as they're ready to get this deal done, the Prime Minister of Israel, who is being reelected right now, who I guess is probably sure to be reelected, I don't know, he's campaigning on doing everything he can to undermine this deal. And there's a very interesting article today, and, you know, I don't know how well... how interested you guys are in keeping up with the intricacies of these policies or reading up on them. But this one is in The Forward, and it's by Nathan Gutman, who I believe is the editor there, a very senior writer there. And it's why the Israel lobby is the biggest casualty of the feud over Benjamin Netanyahu's speech. And there's a really funny thing in here where they quote Steve Rosen, who is the former director of AIPAC and who at one point was indicted for spying for Israel. And you can read the indictment, and they pretty much had him. He was released because of basically just politics. Obama and Holder just dropped the charges against him rather than have a fight about it. So, just Google Raimondo and Steve Rosen, and you'll be caught up. But anyway, the quote from him is in frustration here. AIPAC, that's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, spent 10 years preparing for this moment. And what he's saying is, the timing of Netanyahu and the speech and the politics around him coming to give this speech to undermine the nuclear deal have completely ruined AIPAC. It's sort of like, from his point of view, right at the moment of their greatest football play, Netanyahu is offsides, you know, and just screwed them, 15-yard penalty. And would somebody just, and I hate to use a football metaphor like that because they always do, but, you know, it is the pretty fitting kind of thing. Netanyahu is screwing up his own diabolical plot to destroy America's nuclear deal, de facto first step peace deal toward ending the Cold War with Iran. And even have, as previously mentioned on the show, you have Abraham Foxman, Robert Kagan in the Washington Post, Jeffrey Goldberg in the Atlantic. And I don't know about all the different, the American Jewish Committee, it says, has refused to weigh in and take a stand on this. The Zionist Organization of America, on the other hand, is hardcore. They basically, the Emergency Committee for Israel, that's Bill Kristol. Oh, and Christians United for Israel, that's John Hagee. They promised to take action against the growing number of lawmakers who said they will boycott the speech. Awesome. So, in other words, civil war within the Israel lobby in the United States over Netanyahu's ham-handed and clumsy attempt to undermine what is almost a fait accompli, you know? But, you know, I do wonder, I hate to give Netanyahu too much credit, like maybe he's smart, but I wonder if he knows something we don't know. Like there's about to be a bunch of Jundala suicide attacks inside Iran or something like that, like there was in October of 2009 that undermined the sort of half-assed deal that they were pushing then for a nuclear fuel swap. And I wouldn't rule it out. I don't know what's going to happen, but read up on the history of that. There they were, Jundala working for the Israeli Mossad. Murdered, kidnapped, and executed some Iranian generals and I think other ranking officers right in October 2009 when Obama and Iran were working on their nuclear deal then. And really helped scotch that thing and set us up for years worth of sanctions and worse Cold War and bogus threats and diplomacy and people dying for a lack of medicine over there. And just from overall deprivation from the war against the civilian economy of Iran. And as Mohammad Sahimi points out, the side effect of empowering those that are supposedly the targets, the Revolutionary Guards who control all the black markets and are relatively empowered compared to where they already previously were. Anyway, check it out, Gutman at the Forward.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website with all the archives there. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time weekdays. And our first guest today is a man whose name is on most of my shirts. He's the greatest parliamentarian in world history and my hero. Dr. Ron Paul, welcome back to the show. Ron, how are you doing?
Thank you, Scott. Nice to be with you again, and thank you for the exaggerations.
No, it's all very much deserved. I want to mention here, too, in your introduction, RonPaulInstitute.org, of course, is the website of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And then, of course, there's VoicesOfLiberty.com, which is sort of the improved and expanded Ron Paul channel, which I'm very happy that they're running some of my archives there at voicesofliberty.com. Very proud of that, and thank you for that, whatever part you played in okaying that, if you did. And also, I want to make sure everybody knows that you're the author of great titles like A Foreign Policy of Freedom and The Revolution, A Manifesto. Those are my favorites of the many books that you've written that I've read. So, there we go. Very happy to have you back on the show. I guess the big news is, like in your essay running on antiwar.com and all around the internet today, is about the new authorization to use military force. And I thought of you, actually, when I saw them saying that the administration was even officially saying that they're leaving it deliberately fuzzy, they call it, deliberately vague.
And does it really matter? Even if it's explicit, for them, it's always fuzzy. It's sort of like the Constitution. It's pretty explicit, you know, in most places, but it always ends up being interpreted in a very fuzzy manner.
Right, yeah, exactly. The well, now, the authorization to use military force from back in 2001, they still want to keep that. That's the one that you voted for in response to the September 11th attacks, after you warned against that kind of thing, actually, and introduced a letter of mark and reprisal instead.
Right.
Can you tell the people about what a letter of mark is and what that would have been?
Well, this was used in the early history, and Jefferson used it. It's sometimes as great as a man as Jefferson was. I look back now and think that maybe he did a little bit more than I would have wanted. Anyway, he wanted to exert the notion of sovereignty of the United States, so he would use this in a naval sense. And anybody attacked an American vessel any place in the world, he wanted to even send the Navy to help. But the letter of mark and reprisal was an accepted instrument, you know, throughout the world, that if you had a letter from your government and you were sailing in a private ship, you could act as part of the government to defend yourself and to attack those who are attacking you. So it was more than just self-defense. It was more or less getting the authority from the government to do something in a very limited fashion, rather than saying, well, the only thing that we can do with the Barbary pirates is to declare war, and that was the only option. So this letter of mark and reprisal, which they put in, I guess they were thinking of things like this, to limit it. And of course, there was a lot of hang-ups with that authorization, and they didn't, you know, in 2001, that was actually totally abused, because that was directed at those people who actually participated in 9/11. But nevertheless, they went much, much further than that, and that is when I started thinking about letter of mark and reprisal. Yeah, because, you know, even though we so often can talk about what led up to it, what led up to World War One and World War Two, once the country is viciously attacked and it's just, there's no way you can't defend oneself against it, then you don't have many choices in the matter. But I was still looking for one, and since Al-Qaeda, whoever did 9/11, wasn't a precise government, so you really can't declare war against a government. And it's sort of similar to what's going on today with ISIS. It's pretty hard to declare war against ISIS. And that's why I got to thinking about the letter of mark and reprisal. Maybe this could be done by a small group of people. Matter of fact, can't you just see the difference that might have occurred, that, you know, they knew where bin Laden was. I don't think they really wanted to catch him, because he was used as the excuse for us, you know, invading various countries and building up the military. So if you had a private force that was going to be paid to go over and get him, because they had pretty good knowledge of where he was, and taking care of him early on, just think of the benefits that would have come from a very, very narrowed approach to, you know, going after those people that were participating in 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is, you were probably pretty much alone on Capitol Hill of having a realistic assessment of just how big of an organization Al-Qaeda was, and saw 9/11 sort of as the desperate Hail Mary kind mm-hmm. of attack that it was, rather than the believing in this giant caliphate that they said was coming to get us, but that didn't really exist out there. But they were just looking to exploit it and get away with murder. But your way,
yeah.
I agreed. I remember thinking back then, boy, if they would listen to Ron Paul, this thing would be over by Christmas.
Yeah, but, you know, again, the extent of al-Qaeda was one thing, but the nature of al-Qaeda was something else, because I still don't think it's a monolith. Yes, it looks like they're getting organized under a force in Iraq and Syria, conditions which we created, but they're still talking about 30,000. And what about the millions? How many millions of people are around that area that claim they don't like them, everywhere from Israel on to Turkey and Syria and Iran? Nobody likes them, and yet there's apparent success. So it's more than, you know, fighting a country, because there's people who support these people and at least, you know, go along with it, and they're not willing to fight them. But that's why I think it gets to be silly if they think they're going to ever declare war against ISIS. I compared this to back in the 50s and the 40s or so, declaring war against communism. Well, you can declare war against the Soviet Union, but you can't declare war against communism, because it's pervasive. It's all over the place. And people who are angry at us now and have been radicalized and feel desperate, they do want to do, they're anxious to do something. And I think right now there's a real question about the 20,000. You know, everybody accepts, well, how many people are on the way to Syria? 20,000. You know, it's going to go from 30 to 50,000 in one day, and we're going to be in that much trouble. So that's the reason we have to vote for more authority and more weapons. It's just the biggest mess I can conceive of in foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it's true that when you talk about listing off all the people who are their enemies in the region who are against them, you include everybody they've conquered, too, or pretty much everybody they've conquered, because we've seen how these guys acted in the past, where it was the Sunni-based insurgency themselves, their allies, that turned on al-Qaeda and got rid of them back in 2006 and 7. And
right.
So, and they're such horrible guys, they obviously... you know, have no concept of, you thought America was bad at counterinsurgency. They have no concept of hearts and minds whatsoever, apparently.
Yeah.
They're happy to turn everyone against them. So
it really hurts us who are trying to get the people to understand what's really going on, because all you have to do is have one person burned to death or one people beheaded, and they don't think about the 60 that were beheaded in Saudi Arabia, you know, last year, and how Saudi Arabia may well have been instrumental, especially in the financing of 9/11. These kind of things, it just sort of distract, and the people concentrate on this. But that's all part of the war propaganda. But nobody, and if we would suggest, well, how would you feel if you were out, you know, at a funeral, and lo and behold, a cruise missile was misplaced, and they killed my whole family, or they killed my cousin or my friends? How many people would feel outraged about that? But nobody wants to look at it that way, no matter how many people have died at the hands of our foreign policy. And there have been many. Some estimate it could be a million Iraqis died since
Hold it right there, Dr. Paul. We'll be right back, everybody, with Ron Paul after this. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with the great Dr. Ron Paul, anti-war activist. And we're talking about the past and future of the war on terrorism, really, and sorry about the heartbreak interrupting you there, Dr. Paul, but where we left off, you were talking about a little bit of that put the shoe on the other foot kind of thing. And,
yeah.
You know, it's so important that, as I saw in a recent interview you did with Newsmax TV, where you were basically explaining, hey, history was already going on before September 11th happened. It reminded me of the talk you gave on C-SPAN in 1998 warning during Operation Desert Fox, the bombing campaign against Iraq, that this is the kind of thing that could lead to terrorist attacks against us and that kind of thing. A few different examples of that before September 11th. And, but, geez, now I'm sorry. I know what I was going to say. The Newsmax interview. I was thinking, if only you said it was Bill Clinton's policies that led to this, then maybe he, because he almost understood, you know, that the 1990s existed. It maybe made a little bit partisan. Maybe the Republicans could get their head around that. Maybe it didn't all just start because the Quran said kill whitey or something like that. But maybe America had done something to get us into this mess. Our government had done something to get us into this mess.
It's really amazing how much partisanism there is, and yet the party are the same. You know, they all believe in the foreign policy of intervention and the Federal Reserve and welfare and spending and deficits and central economic plan and all that, yet they really do fight tooth and nail. But I think that's part of the things that they've been snowed on. I mean, the hardcore Republicans and hardcore Democrats give up all their beliefs when it becomes a partisan thing. I came across that when we were fighting these wars, and Dennis Kucinich, who's an honest progressive Democrat, I could work with him and other Democrats. But too often, there were a bunch of the Democrats that worked real hard with us to try to stop Bush's war, but immediately wouldn't say boo to Obama. And now, if I come out and say, well, you know, I sympathize, and I think I did that on Newsmax one time, that I sympathize with Obama's statement about, hey, why more sanctions on Iran right now? Why not let us talk a little bit about it? And when you listen to his words, I don't know how sincere he is, but I gave him the benefit of the doubt, because I'd much rather him wanting to talk to the Iranians rather than saying, well, it's time to bomb. I guess we'll put McCain in charge of all this and let him go ahead. But then they come down hard on you. You know, the conservatives come down hard on you. They say, oh, you're a Bush lover. Or you're an Obama lover. And then if you say something about, why don't we have an understanding of what's going on in Ukraine? Oh, you're just a Putin lover. You know, Putin, you say anything which tries to explain why there's a civil war going on there and why NATO's fighting Russia, then they, of course, want to destroy your argument only by, character assassination. But that's the way things have been for a long time, and the only way we can confront that is with as many facts as we can get out there, and shows like yours and what we all try to do. And fortunately, we have more ability to do this now than in the old days. It used to be very difficult for our side, and with people like Snowden around, it becomes even easier for us. But there's still a lot of ignorance out there, and there's a lot of need to just go along. You can imagine how the zombies will follow Hillary once she gets rolling.
Right. Yeah, we saw that with the recent Washington Times series on the Libya war, where almost uniformly the conservatives are just as bad as her on it, the Republicans, and so they don't want to make much hay of it, even though it's in their newspaper, the Washington Times there, and the liberals don't want to say anything about it, even though that series is just absolutely huge, the scandal behind how, you know, even the Pentagon tried to stop her, but nobody could in getting us into that thing.
But even the strongest critics from the Republicans aren't saying, well, you know, this could have all been avoided if we wouldn't have decided that we had to get rid of Gaddafi at this particular time. I mean, we were in there, we messed it up, and look at what's there now. Total chaos. But it's either going to be they didn't use enough force, or Hillary screwed up by using the force that she did have, and her policies weren't correct. But they never look at the overall policy of the downside of foreign interventionism.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, back when, I don't know, 10 years ago, when they were pushing all this stuff, they kept threatening that this Islamo-fascist caliphate is getting us, right? As you were talking about before, inflating al-Qaeda into this almost, you know, Soviet Empire-sized, thing that needs to be battled. It was a fantasy of bin Laden's. It was a fantasy of George Bush's. And yet, it seems like that kind of is what has replaced the old Ba'ath regime in the predominantly Sunni parts of Iraq and Syria now, with this guy, Baghdadi, who is, for intents and purposes, bin Laden himself up there on the balcony like Mussolini, declaring himself the caliph and all this kind of thing. So just playing devil's advocate as best I can here, Dr. Paul. Is it possible that maybe we need to fight one more real good war here against these particularly heinous guys, the guys that Bush pretended Saddam was, and only then maybe quit?
I'm not quite ready to go in and try to clean up the mess with our money and our troops. But I do think they're stronger. They seem to be more organized. But that's not so much that their philosophy is winning out, that they're such they get in such support, but they're getting support out of default, out of our failure. It was sort of, how did we beat the Soviets? We didn't beat them by, you know, military might. We beat them by them beating themselves because they had a non-viable system. But the more we get involved, the more we enhance our enemies. Because, you know, the biggest thing is the incentive. The more we're blamed for everything that goes wrong and everybody that dies over there, and now it'll be Ukraine and elsewhere because we are involved. And most of it's justified, but some isn't justified. But we can be the whipping boy, and they can blame us. But then, even in a practical sense, I can't believe they do it on purpose, but sometimes it's so stupid, it seems like it is, that we sending weapons into Syria because we had to get rid of Assad. Well, they didn't even, and then they listened to McCain. Oh, I know who the good guys are. We'll send them weapons. Now, who would have ever guessed that there was chaos over there and the weapons might end up in the hands of somebody that we don't like? So we incentivize them and we give them their weapons. I mean, look at how many weapons and energy that we ignited in Afghanistan, and how the CIA supported the radicalization of Wahhabism, you know, in Saudi Arabia. So I think it's if one argues it looks like they're stronger than ever and it looks bad. I think it's a mere reflection of our stupidity and the failure of our side presenting an alternative philosophic system, and that's where our downfall is. So I don't think ISIS is something that you attack militarily. I think we didn't defeat the Soviets that way. We couldn't. They had already killed 100 million. And we became allies of theirs. But it was defeated philosophically, and I think that's what has to happen. But it can't be if we're going to finance them and do enough harm that all it does is they don't. I'm sure there's still some good feeling in that part of the world for us, but I think everything we do, it diminishes the good feeling for America that used to exist.
Yeah, very good point. All right, again, everybody, that's Dr. Ron Paul at the Ron Paul Institute. That's ronpaulinstitute.org and also voicesofliberty.com. And I'm under the impression, Dr. Paul, that you actually have a new project in the works coming out. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Well, I have several, and I'm not quite ready to. I do have I do have a book on war that I want to get out, and I think we're going to be modifying the channel and our broadcasting, but it's not quite ready yet.
Okay, well, that's great to know, though, a new book coming out about the war.
Well, it's war as an issue rather than a war. You know, it's written from a personal viewpoint, from my early remembrance of World War II and all the things that, you know, how did I become so anti-war? It wasn't that I you know, had it in one single day. And it was, as the years went on, I became stronger. And, of course, in Washington, it seems like some people become more enamored by the establishment. But the longer I was in Washington, the more adamant I was against the establishment, especially of the wars. And it hasn't hurt me for my arguments that I did spend some time in the military. So it's a lot more difficult for the attacks on me that they can put on others. But anyway, that will be out someday as soon as I get it ready.
Okay, great. Well, certainly looking forward to that. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Good to talk to you, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Ron Paul. He's at ronpaulinstitute.org and voicesofliberty.com. The books are The Revolution, A Manifesto, and The Fed. and A Foreign Policy of Freedom. That's a collection of foreign policy speeches that Dr. Paul gave starting, I believe, in the late 70s and then all the way up through the early 2000s, which is such a great read. You got to get your hands on it, Foreign Policy of Freedom. And we'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right. Welcome back, guys. I'm Scott. It's my show. Scott Horton Show. All right, our spotlight today on antiwar.com is a great read. I really like this. That's why I chose it for the spotlight. The Ambitions Driving the Ukraine Consensus by our friend Scott McConnell at the American Conservative Magazine. Welcome back to the show. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Happy to be back.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. And really like this article. Kind of one of those facepalm shaking my head sort of things here, as I am afraid I agree with you about so much of this. But I guess we need to start off with the news here, which is that they have reached a ceasefire agreement, another one in Minsk. The Germans, the French, the Russians, the Ukrainians, I believe, quadrilateral, is that what they call them, talks there?
Yeah.
And it's set to kick in on Sunday. And then the other news opposite of that is the U.S. is sending army trainers to help get the Ukrainian military prepared for battle. What do you think?
I missed the trainers news. I had seen that there was a ceasefire, and I thought that was pretty good news because it would slow down the kind of march in Washington to get involved in something that is has really no good outcomes for America and only bad ones. And I thought, my sense is that Obama is probably the only person of any power inside the Beltway who doesn't really want to, who realizes it's a bad idea to get involved in Ukraine against Russia. But everybody in the whole in the Congress and the foreign affairs bureaucracy, or to say 80 or 90% of them, think, you know, yeah, boy, we've got to go show this bad guy Putin. And the Europeans are trying to kind of slow this down. I mean, it's more in their neighborhood. And I don't know how well a ceasefire would work, but it would at least lead to the beginning of a diplomatic solution, which would hopefully cool down Ukraine as a big hotspot. But if we're sending trainers, that's not good.
Yeah. Well, trainers aside for the moment, do you think if Obama, either personally or by way of an actual trusted proxy, counseled the Kiev government that, hey, we want you to actually abide by the ceasefire this time and really make a deal here and not just have a on-again, off-again battle for, you know, war in the East for another year, does he even have that much influence over them at this point? Or?
Well, I think if they got a very clear message from America that, I mean, it would have to be a brutal message, but the message would have to be, look, America doesn't care that much about you, and America is not going to risk its broad, you know, relationship, which is correct and cordial, with Russia over Ukraine. And that's, I mean, I honestly don't know who was responsible for the breakdown of the final ceasefires. And Ukraine is in, I mean, big parts of the population are full of mutual hatred and a civil war thing. But if the most anti-Russian Ukrainians believe that they have America on their side, they're not going to compromise, or they're going to be less, they're more going to be more resistant to compromising. And so, you know, they really need the message that it'd be hard to say, I mean, it'd be hard to put it, I mean, it would be a diplomatic way to put it, that, you know, no, you're just not that important to us.
Yeah. Well, now, so what's interesting there is what you said about, I mean, you sound actually quite amazed, and I know you've been paying attention to politics in the nation's capital for a long, long time here, with a very smart view of how these things go, but you kind of sound a little beside yourself at the consensus here about what must be done in the face of all reason.
Yeah, no, it's true. I am a little bit surprised because I had rather thought that after the experience of the George W. Bush presidency, that Democrats and some Republicans would be a little bit chastened about the utility of military force and American intervention. And also, I often think that a lot of what drives American hawkishness and interventionism is in the Middle East is Israel, and people who care a lot about Israel and take political cues from what the Israeli government wants in one way or another. But that doesn't seem to be the case in this instance. As far as I can tell, Israel is, you know, has pretty good relations with Russia. I mean, didn't even vote for the various UN condemnations of Russia, I think, abstained. And the Israeli foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who's a Russian, was pretty well received in Moscow recently. So it's not that. And I'm trying to figure out what it is. Why is it that you can get an almost unanimous consensus? I would say 90% of the House and Senate, I'm not sure what votes there have been, in favor of getting involved militarily in, you know, starting an escalation in which there's really no obvious exit ramps and there's no obvious American interest at stake, and in which if you play it out down the road and try to figure out what's going to happen, it's only bad things can happen from it. And it's a mystery to me. So I tried to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, even it's to me, obviously the consequences are, well, I don't know exactly how you compare, but considering the H-bombs, you got to figure the consequences could be so much more severe. But it seems about the same level of stupidity as getting into the Iraq war, only I would say with much tighter consensus. They had to really beat everybody over the head with Iraq for a year and a half to get us into that thing.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's a very tight consensus here. I mean, James Carden had a piece where he pointed to the few very notable exceptions on the level that anybody listens to, like Mearsheimer or Walt or Kissinger Associates coming out with a few small dissents, one dissent at Brookings. But as you say in your article, on the Sunday morning news shows, on all of them, every guest, everybody knows that there's just no question, Russia started this, we got to finish it somehow.
Yeah. No, I mean, and the patronizing way in which John Kerry, I mean, I tend to have a sort of hopeful view about John Kerry. I think he's a smart man and everything. But he insists on talking about Putin as if Putin is like a child who just doesn't see, you know, the enlightened ways of the West. But we're going to give him an off-ramp, you know, and if he would just take that off-ramp. I mean, and it's you know, on the part of America, it's patronizing and ignorant. I'm a little bit hopeful that there could be a breakthrough in the Beltway. I mean, there's some I talked to a friend last night who's a friend of a friend of a congressman, Dana Rohrabacher, who's a pretty right-wing veteran Republican congressman from California. And he is he thinks his policy is disastrous. He has a very nuanced and mixed view of Russia. And I have the feeling that if he starts speaking out, there'll be kind of novelty interest. Ooh, a right-wing Republican who is, you know, not Pat Buchanan, who's anti-war, and he'll get some attention, and then it'll maybe start the things from moving a little bit.
Place your bets, everybody. Dana Rohrabacher to the rescue. No, no, but you're right, though. I mean, he has a real thing about you know, he's basically afraid of China and wants to ally outright with Russia against them. So, whatever. As long as he wants to tell the truth about this in a loud way, as you're referring to, that's good enough for me for now.
Yeah, I don't know the whole thing of his worldview, and there's probably things I distrust about it. But I mean, the policy we're pursuing, I mean, can only force Putin or his possible successors to think that they have to ally themselves and get closer to China, which I don't think that's particularly an American interest. I think it's at all, and I don't know what they're thinking. So.
Yeah. Well, that's a good place to pick this conversation up on the other side of this break. It's Scott McConnell from the American Conservative Magazine. This article is the spotlight today on antiwar.com. The ambitions driving the Ukraine consensus. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for all the archives, etc., etc. Talking with Scott McConnell from the American Conservative Magazine. The piece is The Ambitions Driving the Ukraine Consensus. As wrong-headed as it is. Now, Scott, where we were interrupted by the break there, the question was about pushing Russia into a closer alliance, or whatever you call it, a closer relationship with China. Healing that old Sino-Soviet split. And I wonder, now that the Cold War is over, what difference does that make necessarily?
Well, American relations with China are still quite correct, but there's almost no international theory by which there isn't going to be greater competition in the next one or two or three decades, and probably military competition, and our actions may be fueling that. And I'm sure the Chinese have no desire to have American bases or influence anywhere near them. So it seems to me that it's more likely that competition can be managed peacefully if it's a kind of triangular relationship, and China has a Russia on its borders that it has to think about, rather than a joint Russian-Chinese anti-American alliance. Though I don't think that's the main reason to worry about the collapse of decent relations with Russia. I think that there's a lot of benefits to having good relations. Among them are nuclear proliferation. There is a lot of, nuclear materials. I don't know, actually loose nuclear weapons and stuff, but in the former Soviet sphere. And if Russians become convinced, including like Russian generals and administrators, that the United States is determined to destroy them and break up Russia, and I don't want to underestimate the possibilities of Russian paranoia, and I think that some of that paranoia may be somewhat justified. They could find ways to make life much uglier for the West. I think our stakes in having relatively even keel relationships with Russia far outweigh those of provoking them, which we're doing.
All right, now Robert Perry at Consortium News has this theory that I wonder if you think that maybe this is a little bit of an answer to your question of what's driving, other than obviously the personal ambition and all that, which we can talk about all that stuff in a minute because that's important too.
Yeah.
But Perry's theory is that what really set the neocons off was Russian cooperation with Obama on solving the Syria crisis before mm-hmm. we went to war with Assad in the summer of 2013, and that they said anything that can be done to drive a wedge between Obama and Putin must be done now, and here's a button we can push, hire mm-hmm. the Nazis in Ukraine to mm-hmm. cause a crisis. What do you think mm-hmm. of that?
I think there's something to it, and I don't know how much. I don't want to... Yes.
Well, it's a speculative kind of question.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
It's
not science.
The neocons do think strategically, and they don't have. you know, they don't have obvious other relations to get involved with us. And there are a lot of, you know, I think natural neocon or there's a lot of Jewish history caught up in disliking Ukraine and disliking Ukraine more than Russia. And that, so the theory that Perry and you just stated would have to override that to some degree, and it has overrided it. So you, I mean, it, I don't know. I mean, but I would say that there's probably something to that, and I would be reluctant to say how much because I would need to a much more close reading of the sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, what if I broaden the same question, but sort of a broader base for it with overall NATO expansion over the last decade and a half or so? John Mearsheimer's piece in Foreign Affairs, which I interviewed him about, and he explained it. He really, and it sounds kind of credible in a way, he says, well, you know, basically these wrong-headed people thought that this is just how you spread peace and prosperity in the world, and really not much worse than that. Eh, maybe some Lockheed interests here, you know, helped with the propaganda or whatever, but that basically NATO expansion is an academic exercise in practice, and it hasn't really worked out that well. I wonder how that meshes with what you say about some long-term vendettas against Russia and wanting a regime change there, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I think that for a lot driving this is just natural institutional desire to grow. I think that's probably true about NATO. I don't, in my universe, NATO bureaucrats are not necessarily evil, aggressive, war-minded people. I mean, they think about war, but they're not. And I think there was probably a lot of, you know, they believed in democratic capitalism. They saw that they saw new opportunities in Eastern Europe of people who wanted, you know, freedom and democracy and all that, supposedly, and, you know, in some sense, genuinely. And they saw, like, bigger budgets, and they saw, like, a reason for NATO to continue. I mean, a way to, because otherwise, you know, NATO could, without expanding, NATO might be seen as irrelevant and die. And, you know, nobody who's invested their career in that would want that.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, on the current peace talks, I mean, I'm sorry to ask you to predict the future or whatever, but are you placing bets on the success of Merkel and Holland here? I mean, it seems like they really mean it, right?
Yeah. Well, what I haven't seen is how much they're willing to broaden the discussion. I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the boundary lines and how far you're going to withdraw artillery pieces, but it's their military disengagement talks, exchange of prisoners. I'm sure that there's discussion about what, you know, what is going to be the broader position of Ukraine between Russia and the West. I mean, that's the underlying subject of the talks, but that aspect is really not written about. And I don't have sources, and so far as I know, nobody does. But there has to be a you know, I mean, an example which I think Mearsheimer pointed out and other people have too is like there was a neutralization of Austria in 1955, a treaty which did much to calm down the Cold War. And Austria, you know, led a fine life as a neutral country until the Soviet bloc, you know, terminated essentially. But it was not, you know, part of NATO, as I'm sure Austrians would have, you know, would have been happy to join West Germany and NATO, but they weren't allowed to. Right. And there has to be some kind of talk about that, is the broader status of Ukraine between East and West. And I don't know to the extent that's happening, and to the extent in which Ukrainian leadership has to be told that this is going to be best for you, and you're not going to be able to join NATO, and you're not going to be able to join the European Union without restrictions. And I don't know if that message is being conveyed.
Mm. Well, you know, on the other hand, though, you really kind of make the parameters of a real peace pretty apparent there. It all seems like it could be very easy if everybody was really trying, that we'll have at least the outside powers will all agree that they want this kind of neutrality and to end the conflict and then to, you know, work with their sides, so-called inside Ukraine, to put a rest to the, and is mostly what they're fighting for is which side the regime is going to tilt toward, the Russian side or the EU American one. And so,
I mean, it's difficult for the United States to step down because we've had this Assistant Secretary of State for all of Obama's administration, Victoria Nuland, who's been telling the Ukrainians, you know, your destiny is to join the West and to get to have the European future you deserve. I mean, that's the quote she used. And she means an anti-Russian future, and she means part of NATO. And the United States has spent, as she pointed out, billions of dollars funding various groups in Ukraine to bring about that happen. And then she chose the current Ukrainian foreign minister. And I don't know, Obama has to put a stop to that, and I don't really know if he's politically strong to or cares enough, or if Kerry does. I mean, it's like it's ridiculous that a person like this is, essentially leading American foreign policy in this area, but she is.
Yeah, they got rid of Hagel, but kept Nuland.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I kept you overtime, but thanks very much for your time, Scott. Good talk to
thanks
you.
Thanks very much, Scott.
All right, so that's the great Scott McConnell. He's at the American Conservative Magazine. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. The ambitions driving the Ukraine consensus. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. You know, I get the feeling that if I could get George Carlin or Murray Rothbard or some other old dead person on here and ask them about the beginning of the Cold War against the Soviet Union after World War II, Red Scare II, I wonder who was more completely full of it, the warmongers then or the warmongers now? Was it this clumsy and obvious and stupid, the way we got into that thing? Looking back on it, you know, people like Joe McCarthy and all them waging the Cold War at home, they're like cartoon characters of stupidity. That's all just the orange alert, right, to keep you scared about the foreign menace. Get out there and scare the hell out of them, Harry, said Senator Vandenberg to the president, who was about to give a speech about why we gotta stay in a state of permanent World War II level preparedness. Oh, man. How cynical and obvious and stupid and bureaucratic and careerist and fascist in the economic sense of all of those guys. Well, in many senses of those guys. That was the conservative liberal consensus of the day. That was bipartisanship of its day. As William F. Buckley himself put it in The Commonweal, he said, we must accept a totalitarian bureaucracy on our shores. And he went on to describe it, you know, total regulation and total regulatory welfare state and blah, 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 and all of it. Even with Truman at the reins of it all. Oh, no, and he even says, like, with its secret, you know, with its giant military standing army, you know, apparatus and its secret intelligence services corrupting the old order of the law and the thing. And even with Truman at the reins of it all. Because the Soviet Union is going to get us if we don't. And, you know, at least back then, the Soviet Union was run by communist totalitarian monsters. So It was a bit more plausible than Putin, who's no more right-wing than any Republican in the American Congress. Give me a break. He's just a Republican. I mean, that makes him lower than the scum of the earth. That's not an apology, accusing someone of being a Republican, you understand. But I'm saying, they're all as bad as him, at least. And for them to try to portray him like, oh, he's this foreign devil. Seems like people get tired of that. Yeah, 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 Noriega's Hitler. Yeah, 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 everybody's Hitler. Putin's Hitler, huh? Well, wait a minute now. Hadn't he been in power for about 15 years straight with a slight vacation there in the middle where he was prime minister, wink, wink, for a little while and then now back again? And how many tens of millions of people has he killed? Right. None. But yeah, you know, I don't know. If you guys are like me and you read this stuff at all, then you can see how the entire consensus, certainly if you watch, well, I only watch Fox News now, man. I want it as bad as I can get it. But if you watch MSNBC or CNN, it's the same. Everybody, oh, Russian aggression, Russian aggression. We got to stand up to him, unlike Neville Chamberlain at Munich. We got to be like John Kerry at Munich and be like, no way, dude. Even though the Americans started it. The Americans started it. Hey, here's something you never heard before about an American foreign policy crisis. The Americans started it. Doesn't mean whatever the Russians did is fine, but it does mean that whatever they're doing is not aggression. And, you know, after George Bush and his ridiculous foreign policy almost got all of Georgia reconquered by Russia back in 2008, but he did only guarantee the independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia instead. But Putin remarked at the time, hey, they want to bring Ukraine into NATO, huh? Well, I could take Kiev in 2 weeks. And I think what he meant was, I could take Kiev in 2 weeks. Think I'm going to allow you to bring Kiev into your military alliance? Wrong. Already drew my line. And it's the other side of Ukraine from here, buddy. And anybody who mistook that for, wow, what an aggressor, is a damn liar. That was simply a warning. Like, come onto my porch at night with bad intent, you might get a hole in you. That's the law. So, you know, yes, American foreign policy is conducted on a level of conversation that you could get from a Saturday Night Live skit. Hey, actually, I haven't watched Saturday Night Live in 20 years. I don't know how their skits are anymore, but I bet they're probably pretty much the same. Hey, so we're just going to pretend that the Russians started this with the seizure of Crimea, huh? Okay. Let's just pretend that that's how this started, and that everything we do is a reaction to that. And then we'll base all of our future policies on that knowingly false premise. And then we'll see if maybe we don't blow up all of humanity in a hydrogen bomb exchange. What's the big deal? You know, I talked with Fred and Kimberly Kagan and Robert Kagan, and whatever his wife's name is, and we all agreed that this is a really smart thing to do, guys. You know, Robert Kagan, the guy that wrote Invade Iraq, the guy that wrote Embrace Empire. Oh, those aren't the actual titles. Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy, and What to Do in Iraq for the Weekly Standard, and all the letters to Clinton and Bush about Iraq before those wars, and you know the guy. Yeah, I was talking with Michelle Flournoy, and she was fresh from losing a couple of wars, and so has this really great experience at losing wars, and she was recommending what we should do is we should back a country that couldn't possibly win a war against Russia if we gave them every weapon in our arsenal. And she said, well, we should give them some, just enough to escalate the conflict. And I thought, well, geez, This dessert is wonderful. You guys are just obviously so intelligent. You really thought this through, so I guess, you know, we're agreed then. Doesn't have to make any sense at all. I don't know. I mean, look, I know they do this when they want to pick a fight with this, that, or the other country, but we're talking about Russia here. Again, with the thousands of H-bombs. You know, we could get in a war with Britain, and that would be a bad enough hydrogen bomb war that it would screw all of humanity over for 150 years, barring miraculous inventions that just somehow make consequences not happen. But, you know, the British arsenal is, what, a couple of hundred? A couple of hundred nukes. So that's enough to destroy our civilization, but not humanity. But if America and Russia get into it, you're talking about, you know, the few who can afford an underground castle at taxpayer expense or whatever. They have their life and everybody else done. And that's not hyperbole either, man. Check out, and I don't mean to hyperbolize about the likelihood of that happening, but I'm just saying, were it to happen, that could be the end of the species. For intents and purposes. And read Daniel Ellsberg, man. He did this three-part series for Truth Dig. I interviewed him all about it. But he was... Hey, who's Daniel Ellsberg? How come he knows so much? Because he's the devil, man. He's the guy at the RAND Corporation and in Air Force Intelligence writing up the brilliant scheme for how to kill millions of people. And then, thank God, he turned into a hero and finally ratted on him and told the truth about what was going on. But, you know, read his series beginning with, I can't remember the title anymore, but just type in Daniel Ellsberg, Truth Dig, Nuclear Weapons. And there's a 3 or 4 part series there that'll blow your mind. He's working on a book, by the way. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, guys. Wrapping up the show here, Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in. All right, so now I talk about central banking for a minute here. We should do that more. I hate central banking, and I like talking about things I hate. See, so Rand Paul has a bill to audit the Fed. And I hadn't read the thing, but I assume it's in the vein of his father's bill and not the Sanders bill, the sellout. Half-assed version. This is a real one to really audit the Fed's operations. And boy, they scream like holy hell. And it ain't because they're right. It's because, man, they're guilty as hell. They're terrified. And now, my advice to the Federal Reserve is the Americans would let you blow up their family and they don't care anymore. They don't care. Government, you can do whatever you want with us. Go ahead and give us transparency. We still won't fight you. Promise. Say the Americans. Oh, but they're terrified of what the Americans would do if we knew who they gave free money to. Wait a minute. Everybody who's already filthy rich and personally owns huge amounts of capital that they get to move around the place, they get millions, even billions of dollars in free welfare funds for them that come from us. And we get squat. Maybe our son used up in a war and then his corpse thrown in a garbage dump by the U.S. Air Force. Oh yeah, Google that if you don't like it. The American people knew what the Fed was really doing.
they might not approve. And so what do? They go, oh no, Congress is trying to take over monetary policy. In effect, they're saying, Rand Paul's trying to make himself in a coup d'etat the chairman of the Fed. Well, but geez, I don't know. It sounds like they kind of never really, and I try to read this stuff at the Washington Post, etc. They sort of just claim it. Like, you know, the fourth moon of Jupiter rising determines that your personality is going to be that way. I'm not sure if it's a magnetic field or how it works, really, but trust me. How is it that auditing the Fed means Congress seizes the power of inflation? And then what are they going to do? Keep inflating? That's the only danger that they're talking about, is that Congress might not be willing to ever raise interest rates. Really? And then what might happen? Giant booms and busts and horrible crashes and rising prices? Are these people kidding? Here's the thing about the Fed. It's a plot against you in practice. Just like the U.S. government in general, the Congress that created it, the presidency that authorized it. But man, oh man, are they out to get you. And that's what they don't want you to know, is what results would we find in a real audit of the Fed? Who's getting favors? Incredibly large, unimaginable favors at your expense. Might not like it. That's why to support an audit. And that's why everyone else in Congress is running like hell away from it. What's her name? Elizabeth Warren, the supposed anti-banker populist champion of regular voters. Oh no, I don't support the Rand Paul bill. Why? He's threatening the independence of the Fed. Yeah, because that's the best thing about it, huh? Is how completely and totally unaccountable to anyone else in the world they are. Yes, well, that's how we guarantee that they do a good job, is by having no accountability whatsoever. Everybody knows that. If there was accountability, then they would do things the way people holding them accountable want. And we can't have that, because, again, inflation. My God, these people. And here's the fun thing, too, and I'm going to try to get Mark Thornton on to talk about this thing again, because he really can explain it well, but this guy in the Washington Post is saying, oh, yeah, oh, sure, central banking causes bubbles, huh? Well, if that's true, how come there were bubbles before the central bank? Really? That's your entire argument. Economic affairs writer, previously senior associate editor at The Atlantic, now covering economics for the Washington Post, Matt O'Brien. Well, Matt O'Brien, the reason there were bubbles and crashes before the Fed is the same reason there's bubbles and crashes since the Fed. Fractional reserve banking. It's just that fractional reserve banking makes everything worse. And then what does he claim? Yeah, they were more frequent back then. Oh, yeah? And how severe were they? Doesn't want to mention that the creation of the Federal Reserve predated the Great Depression by, I don't know, just enough time to inflate the currency so badly and distort the economy so severely that it led to a Great Depression. Dumb ass. Oh yeah? Well, the proof that you're wrong is that I thought of a, oh yeah, how come, and then didn't even look once to see whether you had come up with an answer to that yet. Yeah. But anyway, that's why, when I was a kid, seemed like everybody was rich for a while there. I mean, not my family, necessarily, but just overall, kind of spirit of the times. This morning in America and all that crap, and then, blam, recession. Hit Texas hard, man. The oil crash. Tons of property that had begun to be developed ended up sitting there for 15 years, 20 years. Ended up sitting there before anyone ever came back and filled it in with houses and filled it in with mini malls. That's interesting. A big boom, and then a big bust. And then it stayed that way. And then a boom, and then a bust, and then a boom, and then a bust. Doesn't seem like the Fed has smoothed out the business cycle at all. It keeps happening. The reason it keeps happening is because the Fed tells the banks, go ahead and make bad loans. We'll bail you out. It's as simple as that. Never mind when there's a big crash and they give them $10 trillion worth of free money and loan guarantees and whatever like that. You want to talk about bailout? Yeah, that's when they, you know, get you for real. But every day at the Fed is bailout day. Every single day. That's what it means. That's what it is in the first place. The lender of last resort, the banker's bank. And if all the banks go belly up, that's all right. They'll just create more money and keep them all solved. And so then that means, of course, the banks get to finance their cronies at below market rates and without the typical consequences that would come from making bad loans based on personal relationships rather than actual viability of a market transaction. And so things get even more screwed up. And, man, there just ain't no way around it. I don't care if you are anywhere on this spectrum from an anarcho-communist to a hardcore right-wing fascist, or any other place in between on there, or libertarian or not, or anything else. You could believe in all of the welfare state, all the regulatory state, all of the warfare state, all of as much as the state as you love government so much. You can believe in all that stuff, but still you must concede that the Austrians are just 100% absolutely right about what causes the boom and bust. It's the Federal Reserve and their endless supply of money to back up the banks. And, of course, the banks, they allow, license the banks to multiply the money supply themselves. And they expand bank credit. They make things that aren't really profitable business ventures seem like it for a while. And then everybody suffers when the crash comes. And then they do it again and again. And then they tell us that no matter how many times they succeed in getting away with expanding their power, every time they say, yeah, yesterday we had total freedom and that's what caused the crisis. Now we need new regulations to prevent it from happening again. Well, that's funny, because that's your lie about what happened in the Great Depression. There was total freedom in the 20s, and the wild cat capitalist top hat wearing criminals, through their wild irrational exuberance, they got out of control. Their excesses caused the crash, they claim. But then the hero FDR, sort of the David Petraeus of his time, came down from a cloud from heaven to save everyone by creating the massive regime that rules us from DC now. But then it doesn't matter if 75 years later, there's a giant crash at the end of the George W. Bush regime, the centrist, compassionate conservative, George W. Bush, and they all pretend that George W. Bush is Ron Paul. And that we've just lived through 8 years, not of conservatism, but of libertarianism. And that it was freedom and the wild excesses of capitalism that caused the boom, that caused the bust. Really? We haven't had the FDR regime plus over the last 75 years, 80 years leading up to this crisis? What in the world are they talking about? How in the world do they convince these people these things that they say are somehow legitimate or credible at all when they're not? Or not. All right. Anyway, thanks for listening to me harangue you again. I'll be back here tomorrow.